The Progressive Years, 1862 to 1876, Volume 2, Chapter 5. 1863, The White Family Escapes to the East. When the White family settled in the little cottage on Wood Street in Battle Creek in 1857, there was forest to the north and pasture lands to the west. This gave promise of a quiet retreat and a wholesome atmosphere for rearing the family. Soon, however, the Michigan Fair Association secured considerable acreage almost adjoining the White property and built a racetrack for trotting horses. As the war came on, this proved to be an excellent training ground for recruits in the Union Army. The activities on the fairgrounds came to be of special interest to the teenage boys. W.C. White later recalled, "The nearest neighbors to the south were the Jonah Lewis family, devout Adventists. While the White and Lewis families were non-combatants, the children took a lively interest in the war. The two younger Lewis boys, 16 and 18 years of age, and the two older White boys, 12 and 14, got hold of wartime songs and many a sunny afternoon sat on the fence and practiced, 'Tramp, tramp, tramp, the boys are marching and we are coming, Father Abraham.' They all had good voices, and I, about 7, was an admiring audience, and sat on the grass to listen. My brothers went as far as they could in supplying themselves with warlike instruments. They built good bows and arrows with which they shot troublesome birds. They were good whistlers, but wanted a drum, so they bought 2 cheese boxes, knocking out the heads, putting the rims together, paper inside and out. They secured a sheepskin, took the wool off, and made rawhide heads. The drum was quite successful and could be heard all over the neighborhood, and when the non-combatant neighbors became offended with the noise of the drum, they complained to Elder White that it was unbecoming for his boys to manifest such a warlike spirit. The drum was put away and almost forgotten, but one day the boys stumbled on it, brought it out, and were having a good time when they heard their father coming home. They dropped it in the woodshed and scurried to the kitchen. Elder White came in. He had heard the din and asked the cause of it. He went to the woodshed and the boys heard the big axe smash through it. DF780A, Pioneer Days are recalled, Battle Creek Inquirer, October 30, 1932. In his account, Willie White included developments over a period of time. When soldiers were in training on the old fairground, Henry went to watch them and, boylike, was marching along with them, whistling in harmony with the fife. The captain gave the signal to the fifers to be silent, and the company of soldiers made their 1 mile march keeping step to music of the drum and Henry's whistle. He wanted to enter the war as a drummer, but love for his mother and respect for her wishes led him to give up the cherished thought of being in the army. Ibid. James and Ellen White were distressed as they watched Henry and Edson in 1862 and early 1863 becoming more and more fascinated with the war activities, and at the same time losing the consecration they had enjoyed at the time of their baptism at the turn of the year. It seemed to them that they must get the children clear away from Battle Creek. James was now free from administrative responsibilities. At the General Conference session in May, 1863, actions had been taken calling for the production of a new prophetic chart and a chart of the Ten Commandments. His position as president of the SDA Publishing Association would not hold him continuously in Battle Creek. The development and production of the charts called for him to spend 2 or 3 months in the vicinity of Boston, Massachusetts. Why not take the family and stay, say, a year in the East, possibly living at the Howland home in Topsham, Maine, just a few hours by train from Boston? Learning that they would be welcome in the commodious and comfortable Howland home in Topsham, James and Ellen White decided that the whole family would go east. They would take with them Adelia Patton, the young woman who lived in the home and cared for the children when the parents were traveling. She was also beginning to give some assistance in copying the testimonies and other writings. In addition to working on the charts, James White was eager to join Loughborough and Hull in evangelism in the eastern cities. Ellen White wanted to put some time into writing Spiritual Gifts, Volume 3, dealing with Old Testament history. Adelia would look after the children while the parents were engaged in the activities that pressed so hard upon them. The extended eastern tour in the summer and fall of 1863. James was now 42, and Ellen was 35. Henry was almost 16, Edson, 14, and Willie, nearly 9. Adelia Patton was 24. They all took the train at Battle Creek on Wednesday, August 19, bound for Boston, with 2 stopovers en route in New York State. In Boston, while James White was getting the work of making the charts underway, Henry Nichols and Ransom Lockwood took the 3 boys in hand and gave them a tour of the city. Adelia Patton mentions in her report that they visited places such as the Public Gardens, Glassworks, Bunker Hill Monument, Prospect Hill, and the State House. At Topsham, where the family would make their headquarters, they were joyfully welcomed by the Howlands. Henry was especially glad to see the Howlands, for he had spent some 5 of his infancy years with them. Noting Henry's interest in and love for music, Stockbridge Howland slipped out and purchased a brand new organ. The old mansion in which a dozen years before was heard the innocent, merry laugh of the beautiful prattling little Henry now resounded with the music of the instrument from his skillful touch, mingled with his own sweet voice. So Rhoda Delia Patton, who accompanied the family and reported the journey in her introduction to Appeal to Youth, page 22. In this report, Adelia found an opportunity to comment on the relationship of the white parents and children. The affectionate parents have often felt grief that their pilgrim life has obliged them to be absent from their children so much. And while at home it has ever been their aim to educate them for usefulness, and to bring them up in the fear of the Lord. When away, the children have received by letter numerous tokens of the anxiety of their parents for their welfare, urging them to adhere to correct principles, and instructing them how to form characters, not only for this life, but for the life to come. The tender mother has found opportunities, though many of them very poor, while traveling, to write to her children. They were written hastily for her children only, without a thought that they would be made public. This makes them still more worthy of publication, as in them is more clearly seen the real feelings and sentiments of a godly mother. In their absence, the parents have always endeavored to leave with their children persons of the best moral and religious influence, who have enjoyed the love and respect of the children and appeal to the youth, 18-20. It may be said that Adelia Patton was one who fitted this description very well, leading James and Ellen White, who had no daughter, to accept and treat her as one. She was one of the first to be drawn into service as a literary assistant to Ellen White, making copies of testimonies that were sent out. While in the old home there in Topsham, where he and Ellen had first set up housekeeping when Henry was a newborn babe, James was taken back the 16 years. He wrote, "Here we had our first impressions of duty to preach and publish the message. In this place we chopped cordwood 16 years since, to support our family, and get means to attend a conference in Connecticut, the first under the message. With this family we have ever found true friends and a hospitable home." The Review and Herald, September 29, 1863. Diversified activities in New England, but James and Ellen White felt they must press on, so after a few days of relaxation in the comfortable Holland House, they left for Massachusetts. Adelia draws a word picture of their departure. The children accompanied their parents to the depot, and before the family parted, Henry, Edson, and Willie, by request, sang the Evergreen Shore, much to the gratification of the crowd waiting for another train. The whistle was heard, the goodbye and farewell were said, and away sped the train, bearing the parents on their mission of love, and leaving the children again without their watch care. An Appeal to the Youth, 22-23. For the next 3 months, Adelia and the children were at the Howland home. While James and Ellen White considered this their headquarters while in the East, their time was divided, Ellen with her writing and James working on the charts, with weekends at the churches. The first weekend, September 5th and 6th, Ellen was with the little company in Boston, where James had been working on charts. He himself slipped away to be with Loughborough and Hull, who were holding a tent meeting in Manchester, New Hampshire. The next weekend the two of them were in Manchester. There, driven from the tent by a cold rain, meetings were held in a public hall, evening attendance was about 1,000. White reported, "After Brother Hull closed his sermon, we made a few remarks in relation to Seventh-day Adventists and their present operations, and introduced Mrs. W. to the audience, who listened to her for about 15 minutes with almost breathless silence." The Review and Herald, September 29, 1863. The next weekend they were at Topsham with the family for the Sabbath. Ellen planned to remain at Topsham and write. In his report to the Review, published October 6, James stated, "The charts are both in the hands of the artist, and the work on them is progressing as fast as possible. We shall probably have some of them ready by the middle of October. The prophetic chart will be much improved in arrangement from the one in use. The sanctuary and angels will be larger and bolder, so that all the figures upon the chart can be seen equally plain. From what we have already seen of the work, we judge that it will be a beautifully executed thing." Ibid, October 6, 1863. He projected a price of $2 on the prophetic chart and $1.50 for the one of the law. He commented that if the chart had been done 2 years earlier, the cost of production would have been less than half. The cotton cloth, the principal item of expense, that could have been bought 2 years since for 10 cents, is now 30. Ibid. A changing economy. The Civil War had changed the economy materially. This was vividly portrayed in a quotation from the New York Independent, which appeared in the Review of July 7, 1863, "Never, since the pilgrims landed on these shores, was there such universal prosperity in the loyal states as at the present moment. Merchants have made more money during the past 2 years than ever before in twice that space of time. Mechanics are, and have been, crowded with work, at high wages. Farmers and laboring men are investing large sums of money in government and other stocks, or are piling it up in savings banks. Manufacturers, as a whole, are making semi-annual fortunes. Speculators are more numerous than our soldiers on the battlefield. Almost every other businessman is dabbling more or less in stocks, or is in some way connected with a government contract, and as for Wall Street, never was there such a financial millennium as since the present rebellion. Millionaires can be counted there by dozens. Princes are on every block, and bankers are as thick as blackberries. Who, at the North, would ever think of war if he had not a friend in the army or did not read the newspapers? Ibid, July 7, 1863. The same issue of the Review that carried James White's report on the charts presented the financial statement of the Seventh-day Adventist Publishing Association rendered at its third annual meeting, October 2, 1863. It showed receipts for operations to be $20,104.84 as against expense of $18,956.36. Association assets of $19,649.41 were offset by liabilities of only $4,377.53, leaving a net worth of $15,271.88. How different from a few years before! The agonizing war with its sacrifices and sorrow had strangely resulted in financial gain for many. Plans for the immediate future. James White expected that getting out the charts would take his time until the end of October. Then he and Ellen would be ready to fill appointments in New England. In fact, he was thinking of remaining in the East for some time. In a letter to the General Conference Committee in Battle Creek, he referred to the slow progress of the cause in the East. He stated, "The cause in the East has suffered under many embarrassments. While our most efficient laborers have been breaking and cultivating new ground in the West, the more feeble, and some of them of poor judgment and tending to fanaticism, have occupied this field. And while organization, spiritual gifts, and systematic benevolence have proved a perfect success in Michigan, a large portion of New England has dreadfully suffered for want of judicious men to hold these things before the people in a proper light." Ibid, October 6, 1863. He reported that Loughborough felt that New England was his field of labor for the present. After commending him, James declared, "His firm and persevering efforts on organization, systematic benevolence, etc., added to his preaching talent, and the qualifications before mentioned, make him, with the blessing of God, the man to build up churches, and have the especial oversight of the work in the East." Ibid. White felt that another good man from the West should work with Loughborough. He suggested Moses Hall, who for a time had been Loughborough's associate evangelist. This, of course, was before Hall's final apostasy. Then White made a rather surprising suggestion. "And, if it be your decision, we are ready to labor in the East, or wherever you may appoint, 6 months, 1 year, or until our work be done. Mrs. W. has been pleading for the East for more than 6 months, and now that we are here, with our children, we unitedly feel that this is our more especial field of labor at present." Ibid. He pointed out that to do so would be a considerable sacrifice on their part, but they were prepared to make such a sacrifice that the work might advance. The state of the cause would permit their staying in the East. "Organization is a success," he declared, "and the General Conference is a success, and the Publishing Association is a perfect success." No doubt thinking of the numerous rumors calling in question his integrity, which had led to an official investigation, he stated, "It cures the jealous ones to see the leaders in the cause urging organization, so that the publishing department, and themselves also, are put into the hands of trustees and committees whom they can help elect annually. The stingy ones are either leaving, or getting cured of their malady." Speculation. The devil himself would be ashamed to repeat the word under the present circumstances. Ibid. In response, the General Conference Committee assigned M.D. Cornell to labor in the New England states and agreed that White and Loughborough should continue there as long as they feel it duty to do so. Ibid. As October wore on, James made appointments for the 24th and 25th at Newport, New Hampshire, and October 31st and November 1st at West Enosburg, Vermont. This would be followed by attendance at the New York State Annual Conference at Adams Center November 7th and 8th. The announcement stated that Ellen White would be with him. The notice suggested, "We shall have at all these meetings the new charts, and a good assortment of our publications. The brethren in Vermont and New York had better send for the charts, Sabbath readings, and other books by the delegates. We shall have every subscriber's account for review and instructor with us, and hope to receive on old accounts, and payment in advance, from very many." James White. Ibid, October 13, 1863. The Westward Swing. "Having obtained a large trunk full of finished charts," wrote James White, "we left Maine, October 21, for the Newport, New Hampshire, meeting by way of Boston." Ibid, November 10, 1863. Their itinerary took them by train, stages, and private conveyance to Enosburg, Vermont, close to the Canadian border. Here they found the Bordeaux brothers preparing for a conference to be held in the nearby school. At this conference they again met the stalwart Stephen Pierce, who resided in Vermont. James White thought that with his experience, sound judgment, and ability, Pierce was worth more than 10 young, inexperienced preachers. He would work with Loughborough, now that Moses Hull had left the work. As to the Bordeaux, James White declared, "We know where to find them every time." Ibid. In good health and good spirits, the Whites pressed on to Adams Center, New York, to attend the state conference called for November 7th and 8th. They found quite a change in the atmosphere from what it had been when they were last in New York State, observed James White. The cause in northern New York, which has been well nigh shaken to pieces in consequence of mistaken notions, is evidently gaining strength. The change that has taken place in our own feelings since we were here 2 years since, when nearly all the brethren in this state went against organization, language cannot describe. We did not expect to be restored to our former freedom and hope. Thank God for what He has done for the cause and for us. Ibid, November 24, 1863. Interesting things had been happening at Adams Center. As White reported, here nearly a whole Seventh-day Baptist church, meeting house and all, has been converted to the Seventh-day Adventists. Ibid J. M. Laldrich, the conference secretary, reported of the conference. The attendance was large, there being a good representation of brethren from all parts of the state. Preaching on Sabbath evening by Brother Fuller, Brother White preached twice on the Sabbath with good freedom. Brother Andrews preached twice on first day. Sister White had good liberty in bearing her testimony, which she improved several times to the edification and comfort of God's people. Through her heaven-inspiring testimonies, prejudice had to yield, and some at least, and I doubt not, many, saw things pertaining to our faith in a much more favorable light than before. Ibid, December 1, 1863. Ellen White's ministry, Mary Maxson, a resident of Adams Center, wrote an account of the meeting. She described Ellen White's participation Sabbath morning, following James White's sermon. Sister White gave her testimony, greatly to the edification and comfort of the believers. In the afternoon, Brother White discoursed upon the subject of the seven seals, showing clearly that we are living in the last days. Sister White again bore her testimony, and oh, how the immortal inheritance was enhanced in our estimation as we listened to her words. Ibid, December 8, 1863. After describing the Sunday discourses preached by J. N. Andrews, Mary gave her reaction to Ellen White's follow-up testimony. In the afternoon, Sister White again gave her testimony. Deep silence pervaded the assembly while she was speaking. Her words were enough to melt a heart of stone. Oh, how vividly were the sufferings of our dear Savior, and the sacrifice which He has made for us, portrayed. We felt ashamed to think we had ever thought our trials and sacrifices great. Oh, how small our light afflictions, which are but for a moment, seemed when compared with the far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory that is soon to be ours. May God bless Brother and Sister White, and all the rest of the dear brethren and sisters. It was hard to part with them, and as we stood, with sad hearts, watching the train that was bearing them from us, a brother remarked, "Well, when we start for the kingdom we shall all take the same train altogether." Ibid. As he reported of the Sunday afternoon meeting, James White added, "At Adams Center she wrote early and late, and between meetings. And first day afternoon she wrote 6 pages of testimony while Brother Andrews was preaching, which she afterwards read with other matter before the state conference. She sat within 4 feet of the pulpit and used her Bible for a writing desk. When asked what she thought of Brother Andrews as a speaker, she replied that she could not say, as it had been so long since she had heard him. When the sermon was finished, she arose and addressed the congregation 20 minutes. Ibid. Since they were so close to Michigan, James White planned to go on to Battle Creek. After a few days there, he would visit some of the leading Michigan churches. He was eager to introduce the new charts. But first he and Ellen wanted to spend a weekend at Brookfield, where the Abbeys lived. Opposition to organization had well nigh wrecked the cause in that area, but J. N. Andrews had labored there, and now the work was looking up. One weekend did not seem to suffice, so they stayed another week, and God blessed their labors. While there they decided to turn back to Maine. One reason was the need for Ellen to have an opportunity to complete the third volume of Spiritual Gifts, explained James White. We decided to defer our proposed tour of that state, Michigan, 2 or 3 months, and return at once to Maine, where Mrs. W. can have a chance to complete her third volume. Her time when not in meeting or traveling since we left Michigan in August has been wholly occupied with local and personal testimonies. Since we left Battle Creek, she has written not less than 500 pages. Only one or two of these letters are in the White Estate files. Neither typewriters nor carbon paper was in use at the time. The E.G. White handwritten copy was sent to the person addressed, and often no copy was retained. Her book was nearly written before we left home. She now decides to travel no more till she prepares the work for the press. Our address is Topsham, Maine Ibid, November 24, 1863. Another reason for a switch in plans, but there was another reason for their switch in plans. Adelia Patton mentions this. While in Brookfield, New York, Elder White received impressions from a dream, which led him to feel that all was not well with the children, and that they must return to Maine without delay. Each day they anxiously waited the arrival of the mail, but news from Topsham reported all well. This did not satisfy their minds, and in accordance with their convictions of duty, when they had filled their appointments, they immediately returned to their children and appealed to the youth, 23. When on Friday, November 27, the parents reached Topsham, they found their three sons and Adelia waiting for them at the depot. They were all apparently in good health, except for Henry, who had a cold. But the next Tuesday, December 1, Henry was very ill with pneumonia. Years later, Willie, his youngest brother, reconstructed the story. During the absence of their parents, Henry and Edson, under the supervision of Brother Holland, were busily engaged in mounting the charts on cloth, ready for sale. They worked in a rented store building about a block from the Holland home. At length they had a respite for a few days while they were waiting for charts to be sent from Boston. Returning from a long tramp by the river, he, Henry, thoughtlessly lay down and slept on a few damp cloths used in backing the paper charts. A chilly wind was blowing in from an open window. This indiscretion resulted in a severe cold. WCW, Sketches and Memories of James and Ellen White, The Review and Herald, December 10, 1936. The cold turned to pneumonia. As the cold turned to pneumonia, a kindly, experienced physician was summoned, and Henry was treated in the conventional manner, which called for the employment of poisonous drugs. The attending physician was ignorant of hydrotherapy, which was just then being pioneered by a very few practitioners. Early in the year, following Dr. James Jackson's guidance, two of the boys had been nursed back to health from diphtheria by an appropriate use of water, fresh air, and rest. But this disease now confronting them was pneumonia. In the health reform vision, Ellen White had been instructed that the rational use of water would be beneficial in the treatment of disease, but as yet she and her husband were not prepared to use hydrotherapy as a means of treating other illnesses. Henry failed rapidly. The earnest prayers of the Whites and the Howlands for his healing were not answered. His parents did not hesitate to talk with him about death, and even to prepare him for it. Henry's faith in Jesus remained firm. He had an opportunity to meditate on his past life, and he deeply regretted his waning Christian fervor, in Battle Creek setting an example short of what it should have been. This he confessed to God, his parents, and brothers. As he confessed his waywardness and sins, he was drawn nearer and nearer to God and enjoyed peace of mind and the blessing of the Lord. His faith grew ever more firm and his confidence of eternal life bright and secure. One morning while his mother was attending him, he said, "Promise me, Mother, that if I die I may be taken to Battle Creek and laid by the side of my little brother, John Herbert, that we may come up together in the morning of the resurrection." An appeal to the youth, 26. He was given the assurance that this would be. From day to day he grew weaker. Medical science of the time had little to offer in treating pneumonia, and it was now certain there would be no recovery. The record is, on the fifth day, burdened with grief, his father retired to a place of prayer, and after return to the sick room, feeling the assurance that God would do all things well, and thus expressed himself to his suffering son. At this his countenance seemed to light up with a heavenly smile, and he nodded his assent and whispered, "Yes, he will." Ibid, 27. In one conversation, he said, "Father, you are losing your son. You will miss me, but don't mourn. It is better for me. I shall escape being drafted, and shall not witness the seven last plagues. To die so happy is a privilege." Ibid, 29. On several occasions he dictated short messages of admonition and assurance to young friends in Battle Creek, but a deathbed scene not forgotten by the family was recorded by Adelia Patton. He said to his mother, "Mother, I shall meet you in heaven in the morning of the resurrection, for I know you will be there." He then beckoned to his brothers, parents, and friends, and gave them all a parting kiss, after which he pointed upward and whispered, "Heaven is sweet." These were his last words. Ibid, 31. Funeral services in Topsham and Battle Creek. During the 3 months Henry and his brothers had been in Topsham, he had made a number of acquaintances. At their request, a funeral service was held in the Baptist church just across the street from the Howland home. M. E. Cornell, now working in Maine, was called to officiate. Then the family took Henry's body, in a metallic burial casket, back to Battle Creek. There Uriah Smith presided at the funeral, attended by Henry's and the parents' many friends. His former schoolmates were there. In the closing exercises they sang a hymn and then accompanied the family and friends to the Oak Hill Cemetery. Looking back at the experience, Ellen White wrote, When our noble Henry died, at the age of 16, when our sweet singer was borne to the grave, and we no more heard his early sonars, was a lonely home. Both parents and the two remaining sons felt the blow most keenly. But God comforted us in our bereavements, and with faith and courage we pressed forward in the work he had given us, in bright hope of meeting our children who had been torn from us by death, in that world where sickness and death will never come. Three life sketches of Ellen G. White, 165, 166.